The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, thank you. How's the sound? Okay, out there? Yeah. Okay. So, welcome. I don't know exactly what this quote has to do with the talk I'll give, but I can't stop thinking about it. And Dharma teachers, actually, we can kind of get away with, you know, reading quotes that may not relate to anything specific, because it sort of just leaves you thinking, like, maybe there's another meaning, or... it's from Leonard Cohen's last album, a song called Treaty, and the line is, I wish there was a treaty we could sign. I do not care who takes this bloody hill. I'm tired and I'm angry all the time. I wish there was a treaty. I wish there was a treaty between your love and mine. So I got into Dharma practice through really my first encounter with the practice was with a high school friend. And I didn't know it at the time, but her mom was and is a prominent Buddhist teacher. And with this friend, and we were the same age, with this friend, I didn't know anything about her practice exactly, and I didn't personally want to meditate myself, but I just remember having this very kind of clear intuition quickly after meeting her that she knew something that I didn't know. And I could like feel that whatever she knew was meaningful in some way for me. And so practice actually didn't begin in an earnest way for some years later, but there was this sense of, this kind of vague, mysterious pull towards something. And it was, not for a few years that I actually started sitting with a young adult retreat, a Thich Nhat Hanh young adult sangha. And, you know, sometimes people have kind of like quickly connect to the practice. There's something like redeeming even from very early in the practice. And I really didn't have that. There was like no insight or concentration or even peace. It was like I would set my watch for 2 minutes, right? It would literally the time, you know, the timer function on a digital watch. I would set it for 2 minutes and I would just like press start and sit against my wall and just wait for the timer to ring. But I could sense, like, there's something, I don't know what, you know, and it would actually take, I think, a year or a couple years to have any clarity about what was being touched in the heart. But there was this clear sense of, like, there's something that needs to be explored. And I was practicing early with Shambhala Chogyam Trungpa's lineage in Los Angeles, and I went to a weekend retreat with Galen Ferguson, who's Tibetan Buddhist teacher and cultural, I think, I think he was at Stanford at the same time Gil was there. He's a cultural anthropologist. And after this retreat, I came up to him and sort of, yeah, just, it was on the unity of shamatha and insight, is, you know, the unity of settling and insight. And I remember meeting him afterwards and just saying a few words and sort of like kind of bumbling and trying to make sense of what was going on and crying at the same time. And he's like trying to help me get some words to, you know, what's happening. And as I reflect back, it was really this sense of kind of, at that point, there was enough clarity that I was sensing like the vastness of the Dharma and sort of like appreciating like the ocean of the Dharma and not knowing what that was or what it would mean for me. But there was some intuition that it was going to swallow up my life. And that whatever I thought my life was going to be before then, whatever I thought my trajectory was, somehow I was going to have to let that go and see where the path took me. And so this morning, I wanted to reflect on some kind of sort of like the rhythms and refinement of Dharma practice over time, and kind of broad general themes that I see as being important in the unfolding of a path. So I maybe this is the first time Donald Rumsfeld will be quoted in this room. But here it is. There are known knowns, and there are things that we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things that we do not know, we don't know. And when I think about the Dharma path, the path of practice, I do really think about unknown unknowns. that which we don't know, we don't know. And in this sense, our path of practice is always surprising. And part of our sincerity on the path is a kind of willingness to be surprised, to recognize that the path, you know, it can't be imagined. It needs to be walked. And it's hard for the mind to accept that we can't imagine something in advance. We can't know what we're getting. We can't know the contract we're signing up for when we begin practice or when we start opening our heart more deeply to the path. But in an important sense, the path of practice, the Dharma, it's always more than we bargain for. You know, we can never actually know what we're signing up for, how deep and broad a path we're signing up for. And so we're waking up to unknown unknowns. Now, some of the changes in our life look quite dramatic. Sometimes the Dharma reorganizes our life and our priorities, and I mean, it's so absurd that I'm here, you know, in some sense. Like, I can't. This is not the life I envisioned, you know. That's not a subtle way of saying I want to be somewhere else. I'm like, I can't imagine a life that felt more deeply in sync, you know. But yeah, sometimes practice is disruptive. And it's obviously disruptive. And sometimes the changes in practice, the changes in our heart, in our mind, are subtle. Sometimes it's just like this subtle turning of the mind that recasts everything. This is from a novel from Jonathan Franzen, and it's a character, she's speaking about a very kind of transformative experience around grief specifically, and she says, and when the event, the big change in your life, is simply an insight, isn't that a strange thing? That absolutely nothing changes except that you see things differently. And you're less fearful and anxious and generally stronger as a result. Isn't it amazing that a completely invisible thing in your head can feel realer than anything you've experienced before? You see things more clearly and you know you're seeing them more clearly. And it comes to you that this is what it means to love life. This is all anybody who talks seriously about God is ever talking about, moments like this. So there are the Dharma may transform us in deep ways. And yet that transformation may actually look quite subtle from the outside. When I began practice, you know, there's always some sense of like, what are we doing? Where is this going? What do I get? You know, and Yeah, and you know, my experience is that we actually, and you may well know this, we don't actually get anywhere, right? But we stop asking if we're there yet, right? Maybe the parents in the room or oneself as a child, you remember the road trip experience, right? And the kids are asking, like, when are we going to get there, right? And it's not okay to say, like, no one arrives anywhere, you know? Like, that's bad parenting, I think. It's true, you know? It's like, I don't know, that fantasy of, like, the kind of the arrival or something. Very seductive. And so, we don't know exactly where we're going to get to or what it's going to be, but we can keep reorienting, we can keep recalibrating. And I heard one teacher describe, make an analogy for Dharma practice, and that like the space shuttle, like flying to the moon, it's off target. It's like not gonna like actually reach the moon like 98% of the time. And it's through that kind of like progressive recalibration of practice that we actually wind up somewhere moving in a skillful direction. Now, we, in the course of that recalibration, we cycle through so many different motivations for practice. You know, like why we start practice and what we think we're going to get and where we think we're going. Like certain intentions animate our practice for a period, and then they actually just, we outgrow them, they stop working, they stop being inspiring. We see the confusion bound up in that very intention of why we're practicing, right? And so the intention really evolves. We evolve like what am I doing here? And I think we actually have to be skillful at letting go of one intention and finding new reasons to practice. And as practice unfolds, and as our own level of well-being becomes more sufficient for ourselves, quite naturally, the kind of circle of concern expands. And so it becomes natural to begin practicing more and more in a kind of explicit way for the well-being and welfare of others. And it's sort of like, it can be boring practicing for oneself, you know. And we actually find a deeper inspiration at different times in our practice to like practice in a very conscious way for the welfare of others. We start to see how we hide out in particular teachings or in particular traditions, right? every teaching, every aspect of the Dharma, in a sense, has its uses and its misuses. Like every teaching can be a force of liberation or a force of self-protection. And so there's a certain kind of like care we need, and a willingness to actually look like how am I using this teaching in my life? And sometimes I have found that I'm using a teaching as a way of actually rationalizing my own defensiveness or my own clinging. Does that resonate with people? Like you actually look back and you see like, oh, I was really in a kind of self-protect. I was protecting my own neurosis by like hanging on to a particular teaching. And this is one of the reasons that I think there's a lot of value in having exposure to different teachers. And my experience is that different teachers, there's no like one complete teacher, you know. It's like, yeah, not yeah. like one is just never enough, you know. Like, and it's easier when it's one because there's a kind of coherence, and you just march to that drum. And I've done that for years, and I don't regret that at all during different phases of my practice. And there's a lot of value in having a certain kind of coherence to one's course of practice. But my experience is that teachers shine light on different facets of my own neurosis, right? And sometimes there's a piece of it that's wholly in the dark, you know? And there's a lot of value in actually shaking it up to see what a different light can do to shine, you know, how one's mind looks when it's cast in a different light. Trungpa Rinpoche says, ego is able to convert everything to its own use, even spirituality. When we've learned all the tricks and answers of the spiritual game, we automatically try to imitate spirituality. It's important to see that the main point of any spiritual practice is to step out of the bureaucracy of ego. This means stepping out of ego's constant desire for a higher, more spiritual, more transcendental version of knowledge. One must step out of spiritual materialism. If we do not step out of spiritual materialism, if in fact we practice it, our vast collections of knowledge and experience are just part of the ego's display, part of the grandiose quality of ego. So it is a kind of ongoing aspect of practice of interrogating the way that the Dharma can be used to support ego. And it's very subtle. I mean, I don't mean to make it sound too insidious or something, but we want to really be like wide awake to the ways that the kind of ego crystallizes around spiritual practice, around insight. Yeah. Now, there is like genuine progress on the path, right? And we don't arrive anywhere or something, or the path is the goal, and that's true, and those teachings actually help us let go in the moment, and that's an important thing. But there is progress. It's confusing because the progress is born out of letting go, right? The progress is born out of the willingness not to get anywhere. The progress is born out of like allowing this moment to be sufficient to appreciate the perfection of this moment, even though it's broken. Now, in the course of making progress, we see that the path, it's not linear. It's not like we can plot time along this axis and happiness or growth or something along this axis, and it's just this straight line, right? There are a lot of plateaus. There are times when we may actually feel less functional. One of the curious things that happens in like mindfulness research is sometimes when people start meditating, they report that they're regressing, you know, like the stability of their attention is getting worse, right? But that's actually not true, right? They're actually noticing. You need some level of mindfulness to know how mindless we are, right? And we actually get to see more it just does not feel like a linear kind of path. And there are times we find ourselves like wrestling with some deep theme. And the Dharma practice, I think it makes most things hurt less, but it makes some things hurt more. And we keep going. And we're not always conscious of tracking the way we're making progress, but we do sometimes look around and just realize like, oh, I don't suffer in that way as I used to, you know. And we don't know when we let go or how it happened, but the kind of suffering that was so compelling at one point just feels like this vague memory or dream. Now, one of my main teachers, Shinzen Young, he described a path of unfolding of spiritual growth. And, you know, I think we want to hold this carefully. This is a bit of a map of how he sees things unfolding. And any time we're offered a Dharma map, we need to hold it very carefully. Because the tendency is like we take this map and then it's like a transparency kind of, and then we take our mind and then we see how they fit, right? And we like grade ourselves and give ourselves gold stars in that category and demerits there and all of this. And it actually, like the map becomes just another egoic complication. But we can hold it loosely, right, and consider. So Shinzen is a very kind of systematic thinker. So he said, here are like four elements of growth on the practice in ascending order of importance. So the least important come first. Fun, interesting, unusual experiences arise in meditation practice. Now, that is, for many, for many people and many traditions, we localize the goodness of practice almost exclusively in that way, that practice is about some kind of transcendent experiences, unusual experiences, the way that enlightenment is defined in a lot of traditions is not a series of non-ordinary states of awareness, right? And it's not being dismissive of that, but just to say that this is actually just one component of the unfolding of a path. And sometimes I feel like teachers are speaking out of both sides of their mouth, like. And I'm sure I do this too, but there's a little bit of a sense of like, let go, no experiences are more valuable than others, everything changes, it's all about unclenching the fist of clinging. But, right? But there may be deeply transformative experiences of freedom, liberation, and boundless love that finally give the heart its sense of completion. Carry on, right? My experience is that that some of these kind of like cardinal insights and experiences, they are, I don't think there are many that are important, and I don't think there are any that are absolutely essential, but many are of value. There are experiences that are of deep value, and but none of them actually feel sufficient for something like spiritual maturity. The second criteria, said just actually getting a deep taste of mindfulness, of tasting mindfulness in our practice and through our lives. Of elevating the baseline level of mindfulness, the level of mindfulness to which we, at which we live when we're not trying to be mindful. We feel like all of the pressure is on us to remember, right? To remember to come back, to remember to cut through delusion, to let go of the busyness or the clinging. But in an important sense, our path of practice is entrusted to the habits, to the good habits of heart and mind that we develop over the years. And sometimes we actually find that the level of mindfulness is without any effort is just higher than it was. And Shinzen put it quite dramatically. This is after like maybe 30 or 40 years of practicing. He said that his mind is walking to get a cup of coffee in town is deeper than the deepest state of meditation 10 years into practice. You know? Number three, trends in daily life, one or a combination of these. Less suffering, more fulfillment, insights, improvements in our behavior, love and service. I want to, in that to highlight love and service as a kind of fruition of practice. Rilke said, a spiritual awakening which does not awaken the sleeper to love has roused them in vain. And we often talk about like the two wings of awakening, of wisdom and compassion, love and understanding. And they are two wings, but to be honest, I've really become quite suspicious of the wisdom that doesn't lead us to love. That there is love and there is wisdom, but I don't know what to make of the wisdom that that doesn't actually transform our behavior towards a deeper kind of service and connection. Yeah, that is probably just the kind of basic principle around non-harm and becoming more and more sensitive to like what harm is. That this is one of the very few things that has been sort of like unwavering as a intention over the years of practice. Almost everything else has been shaken up in some way. But that sense about the path being about non-harm, not harming oneself or others, that's been very steady. And then the fourth and final criteria said, the most mature criterion is to just do the practice, to keep going. And I thought about something I heard Gil say, which is, it was something like, you know, I'm just so glad there is a path. I don't even care how I'm doing, you know. And that there is a sense of very deep refuge of like that there is a path of practice, that life is practicable, you know, and that everything can take its place in the heart. Now there will maybe be times when it feels like we arrive, you know. I remember one meeting, interview. I was interviewing with Joseph Goldstein, I don't remember exactly the kind of mind state, but there was definitely some sense of arriving, of like some kind of like the holy grail of practice, and I must have implied that in some way, maybe kind of like trying to be sort of like humble, but implying something big, you know. And Joseph's response was 1,000 times in practice I've thought, this is it. You know? Yeah. And so we keep going and we keep seeing like how free the heart can be. And I personally don't ever want to stop looking for my own delusion, you know. And at some level, I think of spiritual maturity as actually one aspect of that is the grace with which we relate to our own delusion, you know. Because, you know, we always think we're right until we realize we were wrong, right? And how we actually relate to the possibility of being wrong, of maybe being deeply wrong, that is an important aspect of the unfolding of the path. So, in all of this, in all of the kind of tumult and beauty and grace and freedom, liberation, the questions, the resolutions, the pain and joy, in all of it, I think maybe it culminates just in a sense of non-regret, you know, of living a life of non-regret. And there's a certain kind of completeness in that. And I imagine that when it's my time to die, that will be a very deep solace. That sense of non-regret, that sense of the completeness, that sense of like the continual path of wonder and of looking. So thank you.